Next case for cause is case 10, SC-703, Elizabeth Condo versus Connors, Roberts, and Porterfield. Both parties ready? You ready? Ma'am, thank you. Let me just remind you that the oral argument is set for an hour, half hour aside, and we'll have to keep track of your time. And that's it. Please announce your name for the record at the time of your argument and whom you represent. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jason Block. I represent the petitioner Elizabeth Condo and Smith. This case is before you on the question of whether the Colorado courts should construe contractual anti-Islamic clauses narrowly, if so, whether Colorado follows the modern approach to dealing with anti-Islamic clauses. I know that you're familiar with the briefs. I will address the first part of the issue presented by discussing some of the history of contractual assignments. If you looked at the treatises,
Would you just answer me this? I'm a little concerned about the context of this case. I mean, it's really a tort action, right?
Correct.
And would you just tell me, I know this may not be this precise issue, but I think it may be relevant, how it can be a tort for a person involved in a business to resist an assignment when the language doesn't allow the assignment?
I understand the question.
So business relationships here, the idea that this corporation has the right, in effect, to have the right of first refusal, and how can somebody resisting that, in other words, the other principals resisting that, how can that be a tort when the language of the business relationships that says there shall be no assignment unless consented to?
Is the court asking with regard to the assignment of the right to receive distributions, or with regard to...
As far as I can read it, it prevented an assignment, right, without consent. And what you're asking us to do is send this back so that there can be a trial on a tort action, right? Interference?
That is correct.
Okay, I don't get it.
And the reason for that is because in this case, Mr. Banner made the assignment of the right to receive distributions. And in this case, it's a de novo review of summary judgment. Question that's implicitly resolved is that he breached the operating agreement with Limited Liability Corporation. In that does not in itself make the subsequent assignment to his wife invalid or void, however. And the reason for that is because he's a natural person. He's able to breach the contract, which provided a method for making an assignment.
But you're suing the other people for tortious interference, right? The other principals in the business.
And the reason for that is because, Your Honor, Mr. Banner was supposed to have provided this asset to his wife, and he shouldn't have done anything to destroy the value of that asset by transferring the asset away from his wife. He destroyed the value of it, denied her bargain for benefit that she should have received in the dissolution action.
I guess I'm not going to answer my question, right?
Go ahead. I don't know that I understand it.
Well, I think maybe this will come at it this way. So what did Roberts and what was the other guy's name, Connors,
right,
and the lawyer, how did, I guess what Justice Hall maybe is trying to say is make some sense to him that maybe Mr. Banner is tortiously interfering. But why, what's your theory about these other folks? What are they specifically doing? Simply not paying out to the wife?
No, what they did was they destroyed the value of the benefit that she was supposed to receive. She was supposed to receive the distributions from this company under the contract and the dissolution proceeding. When they took that away, and it is awkward, I would admit, that the case is, it seems awkward because we proceeded under the assumption that she had a valid equitable, at least equitable assignment to the right to receive distributions, but we're also acknowledging that they could purchase the assignment, or they could purchase Mr. Banner's entire interest. And I think that is
No, I'm sorry, it didn't quite help me. So let's just start from the beginning. So these three guys had this partnership, and he got divorced from his wife, and he tried to assign as part of the domestic relations settlement his share to her. Only the agreement said you can't do that, right? So he said, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. So he did a second assignment to her, right?
Correct.
And then the Court of Appeals said, no.
Correct.
All right, now, your position is, yes, he should have been able to do that.
Correct.
And why?
The reason why he can make the assignment the right to receive distributions is because there's a distinction that should be made, especially in this case with the broad language of the operating agreement, that broadly prohibits a assignment. The distinction must be made between the delegation of duties and assignment of the right to receive benefits.
Well,
okay, so then the question, I'm sorry, so then the question arises, why, if that's all right, why didn't she sue him? Why did she sue the partners?
The petitioner pursued a contempt proceeding in the district court for destroying the value of the asset, and that is as against the former husband.
Right. But then why did she go against the former partners as well? What is the tort, or what is the contract that they tortiously interfered with?
The contract that the partners tortiously interfered with was the assignment of the right to receive distributions. She is alleged is that they approached Mr. Banner. They offered him a fire sale value. He's cash strapped. He's always been cash strapped. He said, "Great, take it. I don't want my wife to have this." And when they induced him to break that contract with his wife, that's the tortious interference.
It seems that you're asking for a change in the common law, right? So that you can maintain this tort action. And we're actually presented here a business relationship, which is probably, you know, contractually, a person could enter into that in this kind of business relationship that there shall be no assignment.
Correct.
So you're asking for a change of law. And then you're saying that apparently, you know, this change of law should have been anticipated. And the fact that it wasn't anticipated somehow results in a tort. Now, this case is over if we disagree with you, right?
Correct.
It's dismissed. There's no tort action that can be pursued. If we send it back, you want to go ahead with a tort, an intentional tort, interference with what? A business relationship?
The interference with the assignment that Mr. Banner made.
But the assignment under the common law. I mean, you're advocating a change under the common law. This is void, right? This transaction, this attempt to distribute the benefits from the business.
I'm not sure that the common law is 100% behind that statement. I know that if you look back at Parrish, it was somewhat tangential to the issue of the assignability of the right to benefits under a contract. I think that the progress that courts have made, shows that you can breach a contract even intentionally, and your remedy is contractual remedy. Their remedy, if they thought that Mr. Banner had breached the contract, should be a contractual remedy against Mr. Banner. I don't know that it's a substantial shift in the common law. I'm asking the court to look at it from the point of view.
Well, shouldn't your cause of action be for this business entity to simply, under your theory, provide the distribution?
Indeed, that is.
But that's not what the cause of action is.
Which is why it's in an awkward position. And I understand what you're saying, that yes, perhaps an alternative cause of action would have been to seek the right to receive distributions. Yes, if that's the question.
Mr. Platt? What I'm having a little trouble with is, let's assume your theory is correct for a second, we adopt the modern approach, which is what you're asking. What about the trial court finding that this was much more than a right to distribution of profits or benefits, but the right, in fact, to control the voting membership of this corporation? And that is a duty. So how do we get around that? how do we get around the statute that tells us to follow the operating agreement and so forth?
Let me address...
I'm having trouble with your fundamental theory.
Let me address the voting...
On the case.
First, there's case law in the state relating to shares of corporation and directed vote that specifically mentioned both the trial court and the court of appeals that says that you should excise the offending provision and enforce the remainder of that contract. If the offending provision here is the controlled vote, then it should be properly excised, the contract should be performed, and immediately the contract should be enforced.
You mean as a contract?
Correct.
But that flies in the face of the interest and the definition of interest in the operating agreement, and it also flies in the face of our statute. And it's clear that the trial court found that this whole thing was in violation of the husband's fiduciary duty, right?
I don't know that that's actually accurate. I don't believe that Mr. Banner, under any statute or contractually, owed a fiduciary duty to the corporation. Had he owed a fiduciary duty, I think then there's a stronger argument from the respondents.
Well, doesn't 70-80-108.1.5 talk about a manager or other person that's a party to the operating agreement owes fiduciary duties?
Mr. Banner was not a manager. He was merely a member of a manager-managed limited liability company.
Well, didn't the trial judge find that this was in bad faith physically? I mean, those are his words.
And the trial judge determined that Mr. Banner's breach was not, at least not made in good faith. Even so, the jurisprudence of this court, what does it mean if you breach a contract in bad faith?
Well, it's not generally a good thing.
It's the contract is ultimately breached, but the non-breaching party's remedy is the same. The non-breaching party's remedy is still the contractual remedy, regardless of whether the party intentionally breaches in an efficient breach context, or if the party accidentally or unintentionally even alleging bad breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing just leads to the same result.
So let me understand your position. Your position is that based on contract law, which really is not dealt with in the briefs, that the voting business is irrelevant to your claim. Is that what you're really saying?
The voting business is not relevant because the Court of Appeals noted that they did not reach the issue because it wasn't necessary.
Well, what about the operating agreement? That it's specifically an interest, and it's very clear, I think it's partially what police blood interest is Hobbs. It says any interest. It's pretty clear, and the statute says you have to give a good deal of credence. I forgot the precise language, and I apologize. But it's pretty clear that our statute dealing with the effect of operating agreements and non-waivable provision says you got to give credence or give much more than a presumption to the operating agreement. And this would seem to fly in the face of the operating agreement.
I don't
just the words. Section 10.1.
I have section 10.1 in front of me. I'm not sure that the statutory language enforcing or giving maximum effect to the
that's
operating agreement is going to lead to a different result. And the reason for that is that Mr. Banner was entitled, and let me address the statutory argument first. There is, in the Colorado Limited Liability Company Act, a standard operating agreement, if you will. If parties do not have an operating agreement, that controls. If they choose to make an operating agreement that varies from the statutes, then you should go with the operating agreement. I think that's what the statute reads. I think that's what it means. It doesn't want the statute to prevail over the operating agreement chosen by the parties.
How does that answer the Chief's question about the separate provision in that statute that requires that maximum effect should be given to freedom of contract and the enforceability of such operating agreements? I mean, that's not a default provision. That's how the statutory backdrop should be interpreted. In other words, if we're supposed to view this in the context of the LLC Act, should we give maximum effect to the enforceability of the operating agreement?
I think there's no question that the courts have done so, I think this court should do the same. It's in the context of limited liability company that you give maximum effect to what the parties have separately agreed to versus their default operating agreement, which is set forth in the statutes. The General Assembly didn't want you to use the statutes in lieu of contract. I think that's really what it's saying.
But in effect, you're asking us to read a different intent into, contrary to the plain language of Section 10.1. In other words, where 10.1 says, a member shall not sell, assign, pledge, or otherwise transfer any portion of its interest in the company without the prior written approval of all the members. You're saying that simply doesn't count.
I'm saying, well, that actually needs to be read in conjunction with the method for transferring an interest. And in this case, Mr. Banner proposed to substitute his former wife. The members rejected that substitution.
Right, so there was no consent under 10.1.
Correct.
And there's no first right of written approval, right? Option to do it, to buy it.
The argument has been made that there was no written offer on the same terms.
Right.
I would say that that had been waived. They had certainly an opportunity to purchase the interest on the same terms that Mr. Banner offered it to his wife under the operating agreement. Had they chosen to enforce it, I'm sure that they could have. But 10.7a, the last sentence, refers to an assignee of a member who is not admitted as a member shall be entitled only to the distributions to which he is otherwise entitled. I think that if you read the agreement as a whole, if there is no substitution of the member, then the assignee is only entitled to receive the benefits due under the contract.
Well, the benefits due. You mean the financial benefits?
Correct.
Not the voting?
No. No, a delegation of duties, I think, is generally considered to be prohibited with the anti-assignment provision at issue. I don't think any of the Farms with Williston and Corbin would not support that. I certainly don't support that.
So in other words, essentially what you're asking us to do is to approve, you say had a contract, follow contract principles, half the contract is void, for other reasons, right? But enforce the on the half that is and use it as a basis for tortious interference with contract.
That is correct. That is the substance of the argument. I think that, you know, moving to the modern approach to the power that people are entitled to, the power that Mr. Banner has, is he entitled to breach a contract? Is any assigner entitled to breach a contract? In order to assign the benefits, that the answer is probably yes. There's little question. I don't think that there's any dispute from the other side that the voting provision should have been.
I think the real question is whether we should take that step in the context of this case.
Take the step of.
Is this matter that you ought to be able to freely assign the benefits that you have of a contract? That's what you're arguing. But we're getting a whole business law situation because of the way you framed request for relief. You turn it into a tort action. It's not a simple action just to pass through proceeds that this person was entitled to have, right?
And the reason for that is because equitably treated it as an equitable assignment. If Mr. Banner should have paid over it, if the worst case scenario was that Mr. Banner should have paid over the distributions.
Right. He gets the distribution, he pays it over.
Correct.
But you're asking to hold the other partners responsible for not passing that through.
Because they knew about the assignment, because they knew that she was supposed to receive these distributions, and because they chose to deny her the right to receive these distributions.
Based upon the operating agreement, the plain language of the operating agreement.
Based upon the plain language of the operating agreement, it doesn't matter what assignor does with this money once it's his.
Okay.
Counsel, can I just move you on to the second part of your argument, which is assuming that we will actually treat this as a contract subject to the classical versus modern approach. Can you tell me why you think we should move to the modern approach?
I think that the modern approach empowers individuals to the rights that are natural to them. one of the cases that actually brought it to a head for me was cited by respondents, opinion which Judge Posner wrote, when the Bank of America and the security interests of Rabbi Trust and the corporation acted without power. I think in a civil law country, undoubtedly, respondents would prevail. I think that in the context of a legal person, a corporation, the respondents would be right. You lack power. A legal person only has the power that is granted to it by its governing documents. A natural person, such as Mr. Banner, has natural rights. He can choose to break the contract, as some people do. He can choose to do so in an efficient breach, if you consider this an efficient way to settle out the forced action. Then this was to his benefit. He was pursuing his own happiness. And I think that's the critical distinction between what respondents have argued is ultra vires, you know, the authority of the assignor and a natural person in the assignor.
If you look at it from a remedy perspective, do you think that the modern approach would provide a more flexible remedy for the person who was the benefit of the assignment, the wife in this instance? She'd be able to go against her husband.
I think in this case, I think there's a question if she pursued the contempt proceeding. I don't know that she would be able to pursue an action against her husband. Generally speaking, I think that...
Why wouldn't she be able to go against her husband?
I think there would be a question of what the issue had already been decided in the contempt proceeding.
Oh, for that reason?
For that reason.
The contempt proceeding has always sort of confused me. So she went to domestic court to seek the contempt? And
correct.
I gather that she won that case?
Correct.
And what's the remedy?
The remedy was that...
he had to pay her the money.
He was divested of the proceeds that he earned. Her claim is that the proceeds that he received from the transfer, of his entire membership interest to respondents wasn't fair market value, that it was a fair sale. It wasn't, the value wasn't, it's contested, it wasn't contested in the best proceeding because she was actually seeking punitive sanctions in which there would have been no.
But so the husband, let me just find out, I'm not sure that any of this is quite in the briefs, but so the husband, has he paid her any money?
Yes.
How much?
He's paid nearly all of the $65,000 that he was over to pay.
But he sold his interest for more than that, right?
He sold his interest for more than that because his interest was subject to a charging order in the Garfield account.
Okay, so she got a portion of what he sold his interest for.
Correct.
So what is the measure of damage against the partners in your tortious interference?
And that's the factual question. What was the true value? What was the non-fire sale value, the inside the closed room deal value? And that's the difference. The difference is what she's seeking.
Okay.
There are no further questions.
Actually, before you step away from the remedies question, in under your approach, we would view Mr. Banner's attempt to transfer as avoidable but not void. Would the partners then have some sort of claim against Mr. Banner for having violated the operating agreement? And if so, how do you quantify damages from that direction? I'm trying to think about how this modern approach would play out.
I can answer your question. First part of your question, yes. If they prove that he had breached the operating agreement, then yes, they would be entitled to a measure of damages. What would their damages be? That would be up for them to prove. I don't think that they would incur any damages. I don't think that an obligor, the ministerial act of writing a check, doesn't cause the obligor any damage.
So then under the modern approach, they don't have really an effective remedy. In the classical approach, that attempt to transfer would be deemed void. In other words, nullified. But under the modern approach, you're saying they're sure they could bring in some sort of breach of operating agreement claim, but there would be no damages.
That is correct. If they actually suffered some damage, then yes. But if there are no actual damages, it shouldn't matter to an obligor where the money goes, or the right to receive contractual benefits. If there are no further questions, I can reserve the remainder.
You may.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm John Mann of Kennedy Childs, PC, here on behalf of respondent Wendell Porterfield. With me at counsel table is Michael Berger, who is counsel for the other respondents, Mr. Connors and Mr. Roberts. Let me just point out that none of the arguments that Mr. Plott made today or in his opening brief were ever raised in the trial court or court of appeals. The real reason we're here is because I think of a mistake the court of appeals made in its opinion in considering the assignment or the transfer provision of the operating agreement to be equivalent to an assignment of contractual rights. First, I want to answer Judge Hobbs' question that he posed to Mr. Plott is, well, isn't this alleged interference not interference because the respondents were exercising contractual right to first refusal or was otherwise privileged? And that was what was argued in the trial court, but the trial court never reached that issue. It just said, well, the assignment is void, no interference with the void contract, and it didn't go on to raise the other issue. So the argument that you suggest that those points were made initially in the trial court, I think there was some argument made in the court of appeals as kind of a fallback position. But it's just, it's never reached in this case. But I think you're right, it's that this is not tortious interference. If not something that they have an absolute right to do, including the privilege to be able to buy back their share, buy the membership interest from another member of the LLC. But let's start off with, there doesn't seem to be any dispute that Section 10.1 of the operating agreement provides that a member of the LLC, which Mr. Banner was at the time, shall not transfer any portion of a membership interest in the LLC without prior written approval of all members. I think it was undisputed that the transfer was of a portion of a membership interest. It was the right to receive distributions, which by the LLC Act is defined to be part of the member interest. That's in 780.102.10. Membership interest means a share of member share of profits and losses and the rights to receive distributions of the company's assets. So what was transferred was a portion of a membership interest. And I think it's undisputed that there was no prior approval and that the assignment or purported assignment was accomplished in violation of the operating agreement. So he had no power or authority under the operating agreement to assign his membership interest to the plaintiff or to the petitioner. And the assignment was ultra vires, beyond his power to convey. He had as much power to assign his membership interest as he did the Brooklyn Bridge. And so that assignment, because he had no power to make it, was void ab initio, as every court, state or federal, that has ever addressed this issue has held. We cited lots of cases, whether it's state courts, federal courts, that says if a operating agreement says you have to fulfill certain conditions to transfer a membership interest, any purported transfer of that interest without first complying with those conditions is void.
Counsel, can I just stop you there on this end? So is your argument that essentially that if the provision paying the money, whatever it is, if it is contained in an operating agreement, that cannot be subject to the modern approach, which allows the assignment to go ahead?
Let me explain, because we'll get to the error that the Court of Appeals made. The modern approach that you're talking about, the kind of, which is set forth in Section 322 of the Restatement, which the Court of Appeals cited for the first time ever in this case, in its opinion, talks about, in Section 322, contract terms prohibiting assignment of rights under the contract. And it's clarified by Section 316 of the Restatement, which provides, Section 316.1 says that in the chapter in which 322 appears, references to assignment of a right are limited to the rights, duties, and conditions arising under a contract or for breaching a contract. The membership interest that was transferred is not a contractual right. It does not arise under the operating agreement. It arises under statute and by virtue of the filing of the Articles of Organization with the Secretary of State. There is nothing in the operating agreement that provides that a member is entitled to distributions. That is by statute. 780-601 is the source of the member's right to receive distributions. So what was the subject of the transfer provision of the operating agreement, section 10.1, was not a contractual right. It was the member's interest in the LLC, which is defined in the LLC Act, I believe it is section 80-7021, as personal property of the member. So we're not talking about a contractual right that's being transferred. We're not talking about some right that exists.
Mr. Mann, could you run that by us?
Okay.
Slowly.
The right that is the subject, the interest that is the subject of 10.1 of the operating agreement is membership interest or a portion of membership interest.
But that's an agreement among the partners, right?
Right.
So that's a contract, isn't it?
No. What we're talking about, what is being assigned?
The whole agreement. Let's start big picture. Whole agreement is,
right.
These guys get together and form an LLC, right?
Right. The restriction on transfer, or the I don't want to call it restriction, it's a condition for transfer, section 10.1, has to do with transfer of the membership interest or a portion of the membership interest. That membership interest, by statute, includes the right to receive distributions. So the right to receive distributions is not a right arising under the contract or under the operating.
Well, wait a second. Wouldn't that be true under any LLC that required whatever the contract says, whatever the wording says?
Yes.
So in other words, what you're saying is if you have an LLC and you're entitled to get monies from the profits, that can't be assigned ever because it's a statutory right, not a contract right?
Oh, it can be assigned as long as you comply with the conditions for assignment in the operating agreement, which is prior written consent of the other members. If you have that approval, you can assign your membership interest. You can assign a portion of your membership interest, such as the right to receive distributions. But of course, it's undisputed that is never obtained. So the membership interest.
Well, can I just return you back to my question then?
Well, I'm trying to answer it because I'm trying to tell you that you're talking about the modern approach talks about assignment of contractual rights, and this does not involve an assignment of contractual rights.
I'm trying to figure out what rule you want us to adopt, which is, do you want us to say that if a provision appears in an operating agreement, it cannot be subject to the modern approach?
Right,
because if anything, any provision in an operating agreement is not contractual.
I'm not saying it's not contractual. I'm not saying the provisions are not contractual. I'm talking about the right that is transferred is not a right that arises under the contract. It arises by virtue of the formation of the LLC and the LLC Act. It's like, consider it to a piece of property. It's transferring a piece of property. It'd be like transferring a leasehold or a piece of real property. It's not a right under a contract because the right of membership interest exists independently of the operating agreement. It existed before the operating agreement was entered into by virtue of filing the Articles of Organization, and it's defined by statute. It's not a contractual right that's being transferred here. It is a personal property.
But would it exist without the operating agreement?
Yes. In fact, you don't even need an operating agreement, Mr. Black.
But you have one.
We have one, but that operating agreement does not create the right to distributions. It does not provide that every member is entitled to receive distributions. That right exists by virtue of statute, and it is a personal property of the member. So the right that was allegedly assigned here was not a right that exists solely by virtue of contract, like an insurance benefit or an It's a right that exists, it's a property right that exists independently of the operating agreement. And the provision in the operating agreement is restricts transfer, not of any right arising under the contract, but of a membership interest, in other words, personal property of the member. And that's a difference, and that's a mistake, the category mistake the Court of Appeals made. It went into this discussion about contractual rights. A I remember in oral argument, Judge Bernard asked me about the Parrish case, and I had no idea what he was talking about. It had absolutely nothing to do with this case, because that case, Parrish, and the Rumbin case involved bilateral contracts between parties for the payment of money. The operating agreement is not a bilateral contract. It's not a bargain for exchange of promises and performances. It's more like bylaws of the corporation. It sets forth the powers and duties of the LLCs and members. And because it says that you cannot transfer a membership interest, which is a personal property of a member, without the prior approval of all members, anyone who tries to transfer that interest without that approval has no power or authority to do so. So to the extent anyone's relying on the Rumbin case or even the Parrish case or Section 322 of the restatement, that deals with something completely different. Those deal with the assignment of rights that exist solely by virtue of the contract. The Parrish case is an example of that. It had to do with no-fault benefits. Those benefits that were owned by that insurance company and that the chiropractor tried to get assigned to them were rights that only existed pursuant to the insurance contract. Without the insurance contract, they wouldn't exist. Here, without the operating agreement, those membership interests exist merely because of the Articles of Organization, filed with the Secretary of State, and the statute. The operating agreement does not create the rights that were alleged to be transferred, or tried to be transferred here. They are not contractual rights. They are property rights that exist by virtue of the LLC Act independently. And that's why this whole discussion about the modern versus classical approach, we're comparing apples to eggplants here. It's not even oranges, it's not even that close. You're talking about something that has to do with contractual rights, assignments of rights and duties under a contract. This case doesn't involve the assignment of a right or duty under a contract. It involves this purported assignment of a property right, a membership interest of the member as defined by statute. And that's why this whole analysis the Court of Appeals came to just is, it comes out of left field. It's irrelevant.
Mr. Mann, so you're making a two-step argument, as I understand. First is that under, and you can please correct me, I'm sure you will, 70-80-7021 says that the interest of each member constitutes personal property, right?
Right.
So then the second part of your argument is that you then have to give credence to the operating agreement, which says you can't transfer it unless you meet these conditions, right? Is that
correct?
Your argument? Okay. And why isn't the second part, step two, that seems like a contract?
Well, it is a contract. It's a contractual restriction on the transfer of the property interest.
Right.
But the interest itself that's being transferred does not arise from the operating agreement. And in all those cases discussing the modern and classical approach, whether it's Parrish or Rumbin or Section 322 of the restatement, those concern contractual provisions against the assignment either of the contract, of actions under the contract, or rights and duties under the contract. What is being assigned here is none of those. It's the right to receive distributions, which is defined by statute as part of the membership interest, which is also defined by statute as personal property of a member. It's not a contractual right. And so when the Court of Appeals veered off into this discussion about the modern versus classical approach, I was scratching my head and I said, that has absolutely nothing to do with this case because those are not, what we're dealing with here are not rights that arise by or exist by virtue of the operating.
Right, but you're admitting, aren't you, that the rights or how you can dispose of the rights are impacted by the operating agreement, correct?
Well, sure, but
But isn't that what we're here talking about?
Well, no, I think that like the Court of Appeals, there was a failure to apprehend that the subject of the assignment was not a right that arose or existed under the contract. It was a right, a property right that existed independent. Now we're talking about it as a contractual restriction on the transfer of that right, But the modern versus classical approach that you're talking about only deals with the assignment of rights that exist because of the contract.
Well, let me just jump in here for just a second. So if it's a property right, I mean, he could leave it in the case of his death to his children, for example, right?
I'm sorry.
If it's a property right, he could leave it in the case of his death to his children, for example, right?
It is, in fact, that's provided.
Right, right. So if that's the case, then you're saying that the operating agreement, he would have to get consent of his partners in order to will his property right to his children?
That is in section 10.6, direct or indirect transfers. Well, no, it's actually in section 10.7 under substitution of a member. So that is actually provided for 10.7b in the...
I guess my point is, rather than the specifics of that, the operating agreement has something very significant to say about what this man can do with his property right.
That's correct.
Okay, and so and I thought that's all this case was about is, so he has this property right, you can call it whatever you want, and he wants, the court tells him, the domestic court tells him, you have to leave it to your wife. You have to give it to your wife.
Well, no, that's not true.
Well,
that's the way it
came up. You have to pay this woman so much money, and here's how he's going to do it.
Right. He determined that was how. He had an order to pay support. He determined that the way to do it or to reach a resolution was to assign his ex-wife the right to receive distributions.
Right. I mean, and that became part of the decree, which is what gave basis for the contempt citation in the domestic court, or else there couldn't have been a contempt citation.
Well,
suggesting, just a second, let me finish my question if I could, please. So he wouldn't be able, the domestic court was saying, you have to turn this over, this is part of the settlement. When you didn't turn it over, I'm holding you in contempt, and I'm forcing you to pay this money, right?
I don't think that's quite accurate, but here's the thing. There's a difference between the distributions and the right to receive distributions. He could assign just the money without assigning the right. He didn't have to assign that part of his membership.
He didn't have to, but he did.
He did.
And that's why we have this case.
And
so since he did do that, he did it in violation of the operating agreement.
Correct.
All right. And so that's really our starting point. Isn't it?
No.
For this particular case that he tried to do it, the partner said, no, you can't do it. And then he said, no, and the first he did it once, and he said, no, you can't do that. And then he came back and he did it a second time. He assigned it a second time, right?
And that's the way he chose to comply.
Exactly, and that's the starting point of this case. Everything else jumps off from that, from there.
Well, if you assume the assignment was void, then he never complied with the court's order. The court ordered him to pay money. Instead, he entered into a void assignment of his right to receive distribution. He never complied with the court's order because that assignment was void from the beginning.
Okay, so the question facing us in the Court of Appeals is that given that this is the jumping off point, what's the remedy for this poor woman who didn't get her money? From the plaintiff's point of view, at least. Can she sue the partners for tortious interference?
No.
Can she sue her husband? Who can she sue? How can she get the money? She only got part of it in the domestic court.
I think the domestic court has its own remedy, which is she goes back to court and gets an order for her to pay the money, or she executes on the judgment.
Okay, so the plaintiff says, well, the remedy is you can sue the partners because they entered into this little deal with the husband and said, hey, I'll tell you what, we can solve your financial problems and you can screw your wife if you sell this to us at a lesser value, right?
That's
the theory of the plaintiff's case, right?
Those are the facts of some different case.
No, that's the theory of the plaintiff's case. Isn't that right? That's the tortious interference claim here?
Yes, that is.
All right, so that's what they're saying. As against these plaintiffs, that's what you did, and that's the basis of our claim. Now, why isn't that something which requires some facts to develop as opposed to a motion for summary judgment? Why aren't there some contested issues of fact there?
Because the facts as shown in the motion were disputed, the trial court found it, and that was never appealed. So, if the plaintiff wanted to take issue with the facts that the trial court found was undisputed for summary judgment, I would think he would have had to make that argument to the court of appeals, but that argument was never made. So, So those facts, trial court found, were undisputed.
Now, the reason the argument was made is because the Court of Appeals went off on what you call attention, I'm not sure whether it was or not, saying that, well, no, you can't even get to those facts because, in fact, this assignment is either void or voidable, or at least we're not going to give any legal effect to it, right?
It's void because there is no consummation.
And so the issue before us now is whether it really is void or voidable, and if it isn't, then, in fact, we have to get to those facts. It's part of the motion for summary judgment.
Well, I think it would be sent back to the trial court to rule on the rest of the summary judgment.
That's correct. So the issue is really whether it's void or voidable, not whether it's personal property or not. And I would like you to help me understand why it's not either void or voidable, if you would, please.
Well, it's not voidable because if for a contract to be voidable, curing the problem has to be within the power of the parties. And here, neither the petitioner nor Mr. Banner could cure the voidness of the contract because it was not within their power to obtain the consent of the members. So if you assume that he had no power to make the assignment because he did not have the prior written consent of the members, and that it was void for that reason, it cannot be voidable because neither of the parties to the contract had it within their power to fulfill the conditions and requirements for the contract.
And under the modern view, he does have the power to do this, although he may not have the right to do it. And that's, I think, the nub of the issue here. Is it not?
Well, as I said, this modern versus classical approach does not apply to transfers of property. It applies to assignments of rights that arise under contracts, or assignments of whole contract, or assignment of an action for breach of a contract. It applies to assignment of rights under contract. What we have in this case is an assignment of a property right, not a right to a contract. And that's why that whole Section 322 of the restatement has absolutely no relation to this case. The operating agreement says that in order to transfer or to assign an interest in a membership interest or a portion of membership interest, which clearly and undisputedly includes the right to receive distributions, he needs to have the consent of the members. If he doesn't have the consent of the members, then he can't make that assignment. He has no power to make that assignment. It's like saying you can sell property you don't own, or property that belongs to someone else. You just don't have that power. And courts have consistently given effect to provisions of the operating agreement. And I want to point out that we do have a statute by that point, so I don't even think the common law has any application involved in this operating agreement. The statute says, Section 780.184, it is the intent of this article to give maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract and to the enforceability of operating agreements. And if you have a statute that says you want to give maximum effect to the enforceability of operating agreements, that would include maximum effect to the enforceability of the provision restricting transfer except on prior written consent of all members of the LLC. There is no room for applying common law contract construction principles when you have to an LLC operating agreement, when you have a specific statute. And Section 80109 further provides that the principle that statutes and derogation of common law are construed has no application to the LLC Act. So there you have a direct legislative mandate, not only you to give maximum effect to the enforceability of operating agreements, but you're not to say that, oh, well, that statute's in derogation of common law.
Oh, sorry, what is the legislative public policy behind that statute?
Legislative public policy behind that section is that LLCs are free to make any provision they want in their operating agreement so long as it does not conflict or is not prohibited by the LLC Act. And I suppose you could say, well, there might be public policy. Can't say a member wants to leave when he whacked.
But this doesn't arise as offensive to public policy.
No.
This is
no public policy that says that. In fact, public policy favors restrictions on assignments of membership interest. And the reason is LLCs are like super close corporations. Colorado actually is one of the first states to enact an LLC Act. I didn't realize that until I was doing this research, but we were one of the leaders here. And the purpose of it is you want to control the membership. It's not like common stock that anybody can buy. It's like a close corporation or a partnership. You want to be able to control who becomes a member because you don't want to be doing business with people that you don't want to be doing business with. And that's the reason for these restrictions on the assignment or the transfer of membership interest, is to control who is admitted to the LLC as a member. And even with the right to receive distributions, if a member assigns away the right to receive distributions, they really no longer have a financial interest in that LLC. They're not getting anything out of it. And they may tend to slack off, and they may not be of any more value. So you want to control who's a member, who receives the money, and the way it's done. And courts have given effect to these provisions, rights of first refusal. It's hard to find, I don't think there is a case saying that we're not going to honor the operating agreement. The operating agreement, if you take an act in contravention of the operating agreement, it's void because there's no authority of anyone to take that act.
Counsel, can I interrupt you over here on this other side? Counsel?
Yes.
Over here, sorry. you stated that public policy favors such restrictions in the context of these very closely held corporations. Where would we look to find the expression of that public policy? Are you pointing us back to that statute or somewhere else?
I think it would be in the 780-1081A. It says the operating agreement may contain any provisions for the affairs of the limited liability company in the conduct of its business to the extent such provisions are consistent with law. And then it says, except as it sets out certain provisions, the operating agreement governs the rights and duties, limitations, qualifications, and relations among the managers, the members, the assignees, and transferees, and the limited liability company. So the authority is right there in the statute to make the operating agreement, essentially to provide however the members see fit, with the exception that it must be consistent with law and cannot, certain provisions can't be written out of the operating agreement or have to be included.
And I understand that to express an intent to make the operating agreement paramount. But I'm wondering if you're pointing us to something specific that favors restrictions on these types of assignments. Or, I mean, I certainly understand the logic and the policies
right.
You've articulated it, but I'm wondering if you're pointing us.
You know, I mean, really, that comes from, that's explained in the treatises. But 780-702 says, well, interest in limited liability may be assigned or transferred. It doesn't say, it doesn't prohibit it, and it leaves it up to the operating agreement to set forth the terms or conditions required for transfer or assignment. I mean, if you're looking for something specifically that says that the operating agreement may make provisions regarding the transfer or assignment of membership interests, I don't think the LLC Act is intended to be that much of, show that much micromanagement. It broadly says it can govern the rights, duties, qualifications, limitations among the managers, or the members, assignees, and transferees in the LLC. So it does authorize limitations on the relations among the members and the members' assignees. I think it's implicit in the LLC Act if it's not explicit. I mean, the LLC Act doesn't pertain to a lot of the other subjects of the operating agreement either, but the purpose of the Act is to let the operating agreement exist to be enforceable, to you know, with maximum effect, and not to be bound by common law limitations that you might find, say, on insurance policies.
Thank you.
If there's no further questions. I would ask the court. I think this one should be searched. I think that if the court does issue an opinion, I think it should correct the Court of Appeals section on Parrish and Rumbin and these different approaches, because they are clearly inapposite to a contract that contains a restriction on the transfer of property interest that exists independently of the contract, as opposed to a restriction on the assignment of a right that exists solely by virtue of the contract. Accordingly, I ask that the judgment be affirmed. If there are no further questions, I thank the court for its time and attention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Platt, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe I have an answer to Justice Hobbs' question, and I think counsel brought it out. The question was, why wasn't the repurchase of the interest privileged? If that's the question, the answers are twofold. One, no one argued in the trial court. And two, on the merits, of why it's not privileged, the respondents waived their right to exercise the right of first review. They didn't act when they were presented with the initial substitution request. They did not act. They refused Ms. Compton's membership, but they did not act to force anything, and Mr. Banner subsequently enacted the assignment of the right to receive distributions.
Can I ask just a quick question? I have this in my memory, and maybe it's incorrect, that the trial court in the domestic case found that the $125,000 assignment was appropriate and not a fire sale. Is that incorrect?
The trial court, I don't know how.
In the domestic case.
But in essence, he said, well, this is what somebody's willing to pay for it. But the issue, again, with the proceeding under a CRCP 107 action and under a punitive proceeding, that wasn't the goal, because in Ms. Connell's remedy in the punitive contempt proceeding wouldn't have been to receive money. There was a switcheroo at the end, and that is why.
That's what's kind of confusing. Was that a different judge?
No, that was Judge Granger at the end of the day.
Judge Moorhead is the one that
wrote this order,
case.
That wrote yes, this particular order.
Oh, I'm sorry. Judge Hart entered the decree? Yes.
Judge Hart was the one?
Entered the decree, but Judge Granger, Judge Hart retired, and Judge
yes.
Granger.
So the domestic court was different than the contract or the civil action court?
Correct. And Judge Granger, at the end of the day, said that was the best remedy. So that it is offered by a wholehearted review. No one raised privilege in the trial court. I know it was mentioned in the Court of Appeals, which is why the issue was addressed.
I guess I'm really lost. What do you mean by privilege?
I thought the Judge Hobbs' question, or Justice Hobbs' question, was that going along the lines of why couldn't the members purchase all of Ms. Campbell's interest?
That was part of it, but I was trying to get at what the essence of this tort action is. It didn't look like a tort action to me that is viable, you know, but that's all right. A lot of water under the bridge since that time.
Okay. I didn't know if there was a follow-up to that that I could address. In the end, Ms. Fado is the one that was entitled, or that she should have received it. She was married to Mr. Banner for 20 years, and she gave up any claim for maintenance. Realistically, I don't think that you can go back and make that claim. Her remedy was proceeding as all the parties proceeded. Her remedy was to pursue a tortious interference action.
Well, it seems to me the remedy is against her husband to get the proceeds that he would have gotten from any distribution, and the idea of him hanging into this LLC and continuing to make sure it was profitable, that's what it's about. And I don't think we're into jurisdiction of the court and the domestic relations. I think he should have paid over the money, but whether or not the other principals in this limited liability company ought to be sued for tort really concerns me.
I guess the question then becomes, if her only remedy was against her husband, where, and he decided to divest himself of the interest, where would she be?
Well, and I gather that you have some facts, so that you would have proven up some facts, but for the granting of the motion for summary judgment, that there was some sort of conspiracy or concerted action among the partners. That's the missing piece that we don't have here, because the motion for summary judgment was granted.
That is correct.
You wouldn't have brought this, obviously, as an ethical attorney, you wouldn't have brought this cause of action without there being that kind of evidence.
That is correct.
Well, I guess it's a troubles me. Is this wrong in the footnote? I was trying to find it. Mr. Mann asserts the contrary to petitioner's mischaracterization of the purchase as a fire sale, the divorce court expressly determined that $125,000 was a fair and reasonable price of Banner's interest in Hutt and rejected petitioner's argument that it should be determined by book value. So, I mean, is that accurate?
That is not accurate for the reasons previously stated. It's not a proceeding, a contempt proceeding, and things that happen in domestic courts often flexible, it seems, under CRCP 107. And at the end of the day, that was the remedy that was provided by Judge Granger. She would not have been entitled to, there's no point in proving a value because she wouldn't have been entitled to it. We'd ask that you reverse and remand.
Thank you. I thank both attorneys for your argument. The case is submitted on the briefs.